The U.S. needs to add 10,000 mental health professionals by 2025 to meet the projected growth in demand. That's according to figures from late 2016 by the Department of Health and Human Services. And despite the growing demand for mental health care, rural areas are falling further behind. We're going to be talking about rural mental health in just a moment here, but first, it may be months before a cause is determined for the medical helicopter crash that killed three crew members in northern Wisconsin. But as Glenn Moberg reports, at least one experienced observer is questioning whether single engine helicopters like the one that crashed should be used for medical transport.
Go in peace.
1,200 people, many of them paramedics, filled Holy Family Church to pay their respects to the Ascension Spirit crew, pilot Rico Caruso, flight nurse Clint Mitchell, and flight medic Greg Rosenthal. The service was attended by Clint Mitchell's fiancée and his new baby, born less than 8 hours before.
I love my job. Those were the last words I heard from Clint.
Matt Thompson, EMS Outreach Coordinator for Spirit, knew them all. He says Greg Rosenthal was highly trained.
He was the rock, knew how to handle every situation.
Rico Caruso had logged more than 3,200 flight hours before the fatal crash.
Rico was one of the most respected pilots, not only in our area, but nationally.
Thompson says all three excelled at a very difficult job.
They are working with the patient from the time they lift to the time that they deliver that patient. They're experts in what they do, and they prepare for all scenarios. Our team was as good as it gets.
The Ascension Spirit flight went down in clear skies the night of April 26 in Hazelhurst. The National Transportation Safety Board says the single-engine Eurocopter AS-350 underwent an extensive safety examination the day before, but there is at least one observer who thinks that helicopter shouldn't have been flying. Dr. Michael Abernathy is the chief flight physician of UW Health MedFlight in Madison.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a physician in the United States who has spent more time in the back of a helicopter caring for patients. I've been doing it for almost 30 years.
Like Ascension Spirit, UW MedFlight uses helicopters and pilots provided by the Air Methods Company. Abernathy says they do an excellent job, but both of the MedFlight helicopters are twin-engine models. Abernathy says single-engine helicopters, like the Eurocopter that crashed, shouldn't be used for medical transport.
Redundancy. In the event of an engine failure, you still have a second engine. If you go to the rest of the developed world, no one uses small single-engine helicopters. No one.
Abernathy says of the roughly 1,000 medical helicopters in the U.S., 16% of them are single-engine Eurocopters or similar models, but they have been involved in 55% of the 27 fatal accidents since 2009.
I personally would never work on one, knowing what I know.
In a statement drafted for WPR, Air Methods says, quote, as a result of our strong safety culture, stringent inspection and maintenance programs, and compliance with several audit programs, we have found the reliability rate of single-engine helicopters is nearly identical to twin-engine helicopters. Additionally, the single-engine helicopters used in our fleet today are equipped with the same essential safety equipment found on larger twin-engine helicopters, end quote. The Ascension Spirit and Air Methods program had to meet standards set by the Commission on Accreditation of Medical Transport Systems. Dudley Smith is the Associate Executive Director.
Programs are required to have a safety management system, and then there's also standards in there about what kinds of equipment and things need to be on the vehicles. We're doing everything we can to decrease the likelihood of accidents happening.
At the memorial service, no one questioned the commitment of Ascension Spirit and Air Methods to safety. Vince Freeborn of Air Methods said the teams were eager to get back in the sky.
We're going to be here to stand Spirit 2 back up. And we're going to stand Spirit 2 back up in the honor of Rico, Clint, and Greg.
Six medical helicopters flew in formation overhead, a show of support from across Wisconsin. Inside the church, the last call went out from dispatch.
Pilot Rico Caruso, flight nurse Clint Mitchell, and flight medic Greg Rosenthal, Godspeed to heaven's open door. Spirit Communication Center, clear.
The cause of the crash is still under investigation. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
And you're with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're going to talk now about a new survey on rural healthcare needs. Let's go to Jagdish Khubchandani, who is an associate professor of health science at Ball State University. He designed the research instruments and served as a data analyst on this new survey of mental health professionals who were working in a rural area. The survey is called Rural Mental Health Professionals Perspectives on Workforce Issues. Jagdish, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Kate. Thank you.
So at a glance, what is the problem with providing quality mental health care in rural areas? What did you find?
You know, I first want to simply describe the issue. I'll give you a choice. If you were to be given a choice to live somewhere, where would you go?
And do you mean in terms of for health care?
No, just for you.
Oh, just for me. Well, certainly a lot of people would say quality of life factors into that decision.
Yeah, and, you know, for that matter, you would not go to rural Mississippi or rural Indiana. And that's exactly the problem with healthcare professionals. You know, the demand is so high, and they get so many options. And, you know, same with my classroom. I asked the nursing students, healthcare professional students, where would you go once you graduate? And no one wants to be here in Indiana, where I'm from. Rural Indiana is a big no because of the quality of life. And that's what we found in our questionnaire study. And we asked questions and some qualitative data analysis was done. And most mental health professionals feel that their peers don't want to be in rural places.
So this recent survey, you surveyed people who are healthcare professionals in rural Northeast Indiana. How did you get the information from them?
You know, we had two methods. One, we gave them some structured questions, and then we had spaces for them to express their thoughts and views. And it was all anonymized and randomized. And most of them believed that it's hard to recruit and retain professionals in rural America, those who deal with mental health issues.
So would you say that the timing of this survey, that this is the right time to do this survey? Do you see that this has been a growing trend, or has this always been the case in rural areas?
You know, it's been always the case in rural America that there's been a shortage. What we didn't do earlier, and we should have done earlier, is actually ask why it's happening. So we have some statistics available since 1900s, early 1900s, suggesting that most health professionals in the United States don't want to be in rural America. But we have never explored the cause in deep. All that we have seen is statistics and more reports on the shortage, but no actual causes.
And your survey was able to get a little bit into those causes to figure out what is going on. What are some through lines? What are some of the things that you heard consistently among respondents?
Yeah, we found that, you know, most of the respondents felt that to be in their place, it's not easy. First, rural economies in America are distressed. There's not enough to do for the families. And then the pay scale is lower. Frequently, you'll have to serve in a dysfunctional neighborhood where there's a lot of crime, drug use, unemployment. And you know, finally, we are also looking at yourself and your future as a professional, your children, the kind of schools they'll get into. And, you know, so most of the health professionals are looking at themselves, their families, and where they want their children to be. And unfortunately, rural America is not that place.
What about pay? How do salaries factor into this conversation, this equation?
Yeah, because the working conditions, the employment conditions are adverse. People are expecting more pay. And unfortunately, the pay scales have not increased in rural America that much. On top of that, I think I'm glad you asked this. When you are serving in this in such a place, you are expected to serve more number of people because there are not enough professionals. And, you know, that makes it burdensome.
So you have more clients, you have more patients that you really have to serve.
Right.
Across the country, it is clear that the mental health provider shortage isn't occurring in isolation. There are strong regional trends at work. The trends identified in Indiana will also parallel the situation here in Wisconsin. We're talking about a new survey out of Ball State University here on The Morning Show. Ball State University Health Science Professor Jagdish Kupchandani stays with us. He's carried out a new survey of mental health professionals who are working in rural areas. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a mental health care professional providing care to a rural community? What is your situation like? Can you feel a shortage? And how do you respond to that day to day? You can call in, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. All medical professionals, not just people working in the mental health area, they tend to cluster in cities. And that bears out in a new survey conducted by Ball State University in Indiana. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The majority of the mental health professionals who responded to the survey also reported that mental health issues in their communities are not well researched and known. Jagdish Kupchandani stays with us. He's an associate professor of health science at Ball State University. He's with us to talk about the results of the new survey of rural mental health professionals. Gathering your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? How does disparity affect your access to mental health services? Is the issue distance or quality or something else? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Jagdish, why did you decide to talk to the mental health professionals as opposed to people in general or patients who are accessing the mental health care in rural areas?
Yeah, Kate, I'm glad at least we started, we would continue with people living in rural areas. But the government has a lot of statistics on annual health status and general health status of people across the United States. You know, thousands and thousands of questionnaires are being sent out and telephones being made, calls being made. But these are people in the general population who report their health status, the quality of care, the access to care. But we never saw a study on the professionals in rural areas. So that's why we decided to ask the first people involved with providing care directly. And we found surprisingly low access to care and high cost and poor quality of care as reported by the professionals. And, you know, as you highlighted the findings, you know, essentially also if you decide to provide care in a rural place, as a professional, you're also frustrated with the setup because 95% of our respondents said that the local health departments are not involved adequately. There's no research being done. And people have so many complex issues now, like unemployment, homelessness, and drug abuse is now emerging as a top concern.
What about recruitment, training, and retaining these professionals once they come to the rural community? How has that been?
Yeah, the time is consumed providing care, so there's not really much of continuing education going on, talking about the latest practice. Essentially, the practitioners are forced to see a number of clients each day and also deal with complicated situations of lack of resources, facilities, and trying to help many people at the same time with fewer resources at hand. So the issue of continuing education, professional development takes a backseat.
It's really interesting that your respondents were saying to you that people really don't understand and they don't really know rural communities that well, that the research isn't there, enough research to even understand what communities need. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere, despite the amount of health assessment that goes on in the United States, I can personally share with you at least a dozen questionnaires that are household health assessments of American citizens. But clearly they have not assessed mental health issues enough, especially in rural America. And so we need more research. And any problem that has to be solved in the health field, the first thing you start with is to know exactly what the communities need. And then based on that, you make a health policy. But unfortunately, that's not how we function.
U.S. News and World Report recently profiled a Wausau psychiatrist, and her husband grew up in rural Wisconsin, and the cost of living was a big plus, but she says she struggles to serve patients in the area, saying she's the only child psychiatrist for an agency that covers three counties. Does your research reveal whether capable professionals feel they can meet the needs of the people they serve?
No, and that was, I think majority of them said that they feel inadequate in terms of meeting all the needs of their community members because of the shortage of people and the lack of resources.
And this child and adolescent psychiatrist in rural Wisconsin also said she was exhausted treating patient after patient with trauma and that she almost burned out. How does the work burden contribute to burnout, to mental health professionals leaving the practice?
And it's worldwide. I think psychiatrists have and mental health professionals are the most likely to have any kind of mental health issue themselves. And if you're functioning in a situation like places like rural America, burnout is a high probability, clearly because you don't have enough employer support. And the quality of life, and on top of that, you are struggling with a system that's almost dysfunctional. And the outcome is either you just give up or move to a bigger town and a bigger city where the pay is higher, the client load is lower. And you know that you'll have enough support in terms of allied health professionals and counselors. I'm not surprised.
So how does healthcare in rural areas compare to poor urban areas? Are there similarities there?
Yeah, there are some, especially in terms of access. It remains low for rural America and urban poor neighborhoods. But still, in the urban areas, there is some hope that you won't have to travel much and you can find help if it's an emergency situation. In our study, we found that in rural America, people have to travel more than 25 miles to find basic health care. You know, that's almost like moving out of your community to find health care.
So do professionals feel a burden as they try to help people? What do they say about coordinating care and meeting their caseloads?
Yeah, I mean, on an average, our respondents said that they are looking at more than 10 people each day, and that's not ideal. And of these 10 cases that they see, frequently they're not able to do the best. Even the referral services are distant. And so they feel inadequate in helping people. And it's also a situation of burnout for them. It's not sustainable.
Are caseloads very different than in urban areas where you know there are more mental health professionals?
Yeah, either the caseloads are lesser, and even if they're comparable, you know that you can see the same amount of people each day and yet expect better outcomes for patients because of the team approach, the better coordination of care. Like here, in rural America, how do you find that a person has a mental illness and that they need a qualified professional? Who do you go to? How do you get referred? It's just complicated. Whereas in rural urban America, there's a lot of big facilities, centers for referral, and a lot of coordination among practitioners, and a lot of options.
We're talking right now with Jagdish Khubchandani. He is with us talking about a new survey out of Ball State University addressing mental health issues and addressing what mental health care providers are up against in rural areas with a shortage of mental health professionals working there. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a mental health care provider? Do you offer counseling? Are you a psychiatrist, perhaps? Maybe you're a member of law enforcement with crisis training. Do you choose to work in a rural area? What does mental health care look like in your part of the state? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jagdish, could telemedicine or online or remote healthcare be a part of the solution?
Oh, definitely, yes. I think throughout the United States and worldwide, telephonic services and telemedicine is coming to rescue for people who live in rural places. I mean, you know, where there's no psychiatrist or a health professional, still your radio channel has the ability to reach out to people, and that's been a good source of help for people in distant communities. So there is a role, but you know, it's limited. You cannot totally depend on something like telemedicine.
And your new research reveals that only 5% of mental health professionals surveyed feel their local health departments are adequately involved in supporting or providing mental health services for people in their areas. What should that look like? Well, what should we make of local health departments and their role in this?
Yeah, I think, again, it shows us how rural health is a low priority for the state and for our agencies, that a health department, which has a primary responsibility providing basic services to people, they are not able to do their job. And I don't blame them, knowing that they have their own struggles. Like, I've known of a small town nearby where I live right now. Three professionals are running the whole health department, and those three people are involved with issuing citations to restaurants, giving vaccinations to people, conducting health fairs. It's just too much to expect from them. For a population of 70,000, there are three professionals.
Do you intend to follow the people you surveyed, follow up with them?
Yeah, we would go to a different population now and do more qualitative assessments and look at how care can be coordinated with other techniques to recruit more professionals. Though we know that clearly much of it is about resources and funding, but there are innovative ways to change the landscape, because where there's a problem, there's an opportunity.
So how do we go about changing the landscape? What can change in rural areas? What are some solutions looking like?
I think one of them is to start with research, as I mentioned, to conduct thorough assessments of what are the unique special needs of rural America. And just to give you an example, of all the 500,000 suicides that happened in the past 10, 15 years in the United States, a third of them happened in rural America. And, you know, a third is not a majority, but still, given the population numbers and density, it's a high number. So there are clearly unique challenges, and then drug abuse is rising. So one of the solutions could be decentralized mental health care. We have to find people like school counselors, school nurses, who can assist children who are at the receiving end in many cases and have the greatest need. Then the medical schools nearby can have a partnership where medical students and physicians can have electives and training opportunities in rural America, which would increase their skill set. Many of the governments across the world are adopting new models. For example, once you graduate a medical school and you want a loan repayment, then you have to serve a rural county at least for 3 years to get loan repayment. So there are a number of approaches, including telemedicine, and, as you mentioned. But clearly, the government will have to take some action.
One person who took part in your research wrote that clients are unhappy with community mental health providers, saying that we need more private practice options for Medicaid clients to get mental health needs met. And still, we know some mental health workers in rural areas of Wisconsin are closing their own practices. Instead, they're collaborating with primary care physicians. How do we resolve and sustain the right model for mental health care in rural areas?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that either we continue to sustain more funding, increase the funding, or think of some creative, innovative solutions. I think both of them should happen hand in hand. And primary care practitioners, for example, are good avenues, good agents of change. In rural America, my guess is that most of the prescriptions are written by general physicians, primary care practitioners, because of lack of psychiatrists. So all the family physicians, primary care practitioners should be sensitized to the issue and increase their skill and authority in the field of mental health so that they can continue to provide care.
Is there a downside for patients when you look at this collaborative model, or is it good?
I would assume it's a good model, you know, more coordination, because most mentally ill people are not dying of mental illness. They're dying of something else like heart disease, excessive smoking, excessive obesity. And so if they get coordinated care, they can also get some general health services. I mean, it's unfortunate that we continue to treat mental illnesses, but we don't focus on heart disease and obesity and drug use that are actually killing the mentally ill people.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Deb joining us from Friendship. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call today, and thank you for this topic. I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner and part of a healthcare team that is serving three different counties in our region, La Crosse, Monroe, and Jackson counties. And just wanted to comment that I agree with your guest that healthcare teams are really what the future looks like for delivering mental health care in the rural setting. And that some of that's happening here in Wisconsin.
How do you see it happening, Deb?
In our practice, there's one psychiatrist. There are three of us who are certified psychiatric nurse practitioners. And that allows us to offer greater access in the counties that we provide services for.
And has this setup been there for a while? Is this well-established with one psychiatrist and three certified psychiatric nurse practitioners?
We've been working on this model for about the last 5 to 7 years out of the La Crosse area. And then we became more regionalized within the last 3 to 5 years.
Have you been able to meet the patient load, the patient demand?
Well, no, but I think we've been able to be part of the solution. And I think that these models that involve healthcare teams, like your guest was discussing, have really improved the access situation. And I don't think it's a total solution yet, but I think we have more and more people going into rural health or going into healthcare to provide mental health care that can be part of that solution going forward.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for calling in and giving us your perspective from where you are. There is a wide gap between demand and the supply of available behavioral health care providers. It's partly being driven by a greater emphasis on addressing mental health issues with primary care settings. We're looking at the mental health care situation in rural areas here on The Morning Show. Ball State University Health Science Professor Jagdish Khubchandani is our guide this hour as we talk about the shortage of mental health professionals in rural areas. He's just completed analysis on a new survey of mental health providers and is with us to share the results. You can join in with your perspective, 800-642-1234. Are you a mental health care provider in rural Wisconsin? Do you offer counseling? Are you perhaps a psychiatrist? Maybe you're a member of law enforcement with crisis training. Do you choose to work in a rural area? What does mental health care look like in your part of the state? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. ...97% of the U.S. is covered by rural areas, and one-fifth of all Americans live in these areas. Bear in mind, as we look at a new survey by Ball State University researchers that found 95% of rural mental health professionals admitted they're unable to meet their patients' mental health needs. Jagdish Khubchandani stays with us. He's a health science professor at Ball State. He designed the survey we're talking about this hour. It's called Rural Mental Health Professionals Perspectives on Workforce Issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are leaders in your small community improving access to mental health care? What novel ideas are they implementing? Where do you see solutions to provide better mental health services in your region? You can join the discussion post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Robert, who's waiting in Viroqua. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very thankful I've been able to get on the radio today. I live in Viroqua, and we have a variety of mental health services available here in town. And at one time, it was necessary for people to travel to La Crosse or Richland Center to see a psychiatrist, because there was no psychiatrist in Viroqua who would see people who had medical assistance or Medicare. But that problem has been resolved, thankfully. We now have the Hirsch Clinic. Well, we had the Hirsch Clinic at the time, but there's actually psychiatrists there and therapists. And we have Viroqua Healing Arts Center and counseling associates, and I'm sure I'm not thinking of there's many other services available.
So, Robert, you've seen a turnaround in Viroqua, in your community.
Big turnaround.
A big turnaround. Jagdish, what happens when, first of all, you have people who need mental health services and they're on waiting lists? What are those issues, and have you also seen communities that have seen big turnarounds?
Yes, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people have to wait. Of all the mental people, 20% who have a mental health issue in the United States, only a third of them will get treatment, and they don't get treatment immediately. They have to go through a long waiting period. Unfortunately, we diagnose them in a severe, you know, end stage where they are seriously mentally ill sometimes. And early diagnosis is the key to successful outcomes. So, yes, the wait times have to be reduced, and they are tied up to the quality of care people receive. Because if care is not timely, it's not quality care. And, yes, communities can turn around. As I said, where there's a problem, there's an opportunity. But, again, it depends on communities on how they are taking action. I feel like depending too much on the government is also not helpful. And people in communities, when they decide they need to change, those changes are long-lasting when they are self-imposed. To give you an example, the first thing for a community is to find out what's happening and break down the stigma, which is a big part in rural America, and create awareness. Like Ball State University students had been pushing for more services, and the University Board of Trustees, I'm so proud to share that this year, have decided to give extra resources to help students. And so it was a community initiative, and our community is heavily sensitized to these issues, and we take them seriously. And we found a solution locally.
So one study participant wrote that this is a low-income rural community where private insurance rarely covers mental health services. And they said there's a lot of abuse and drug use and stigma against seeking help. What do we know about the connection between mental health concerns and drug abuse?
Yeah, their drug abuse is now almost counted as a mental health issue. And it's not uncommon. most people who have a mental health issue would also have a comorbid mental health issue or a substance use disorder. And this is rising in prevalence, especially given how the rural economies are, and add to it poverty and homelessness. And providers have to be careful on providing comprehensive treatment. You cannot be treating anxiety and not treating drug abuse with it. So it needs some amount of specialized training, a keen eye, and a comprehensive plan.
Let's go to Ernest waiting in Stanley. Hi, Ernest.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for letting me speak on your show. I appreciate it.
Sure.
See, I live in a really rural area. We're 30 miles from a big city. And I was a psychiatrist for 26 years, and it took me 12 years to get an anxiety diagnosis. I was in the military, Air Force, and they used the term nervousness, so we had no term. But then I got two of the best psychiatrists there was. But the problem is transportation. If the people out here don't have the transportation. But I don't like this anxiety and take drugs. I was born in 1942. My family didn't take drugs, and I got anxiety, so I take my diazepam. You know, I used to drink moderate amount of beer, 3 8-ounce beers a day. That's good for you, in a sense. But when I got out of the Vietnam War, I had got a dog when I was 12 years old, and I had my friends, and they made more difference than any psychiatrist. But the psychiatrist can't afford to be out in the country here because we're too isolated.
So, Ernest, you found that once you had access to that transportation, you were able to find a provider, get access to a mental health care provider.
Yeah, they gave us AFTC back in the 80s. You know, now they don't do that.
Well, let's get Jagdish to respond there. What about transportation?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear, that there's simple things like transportation in the world's richest economy preventing people from getting care, and especially for the services provided to the nation. I think, when we fix any type of healthcare issue, we don't have to just look at a doctor, a patient. It goes much beyond that. The kind of faith you have in people, the relationships you make, the transportation, other types of community services, like simple things like high-quality schools can help children. 55 million children go to schools every day, and we have to look at the quality of education being received. If we talk of graduation on time and no dropout, how can we ignore mental health, which would include a number of things, including transportation, someone able to counsel you. So yes, transportation is a barrier. As much as we think it's a simple thing, but it's a barrier for people to get care. And in our study, people mentioned you have to travel at least 25 miles to get some care, some type of health care.
25 miles is a long way, too.
Right, and especially in an emergency situation.
Yeah.
25 miles could be the distance between surviving and dying.
Deborah in Oshkosh called in to say, can you talk about the idea of treating mental health issues with approaches other than prescriptions, other than drugs? Are rural providers more likely to simply prescribe medication as opposed to other forms of therapy, perhaps more holistic treatments?
Yeah, but when they have the ability to prescribe, they'll resort to prescribing as a quick solution. Because any type of counseling and cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, does take a lot of time, repeated sessions, and rural professionals don't have that opportunity. But yes, there are approaches in communities that have been taken, like faith-based initiatives, people going to churches and churches being engaged. Then there are school health professionals who can provide counseling and help find children at risk. Then there are local social groups that have come into play now. The National Alliance on Mental Illness is engaged in providing crisis help. And there are other approaches that have to be taken. And that's why I mentioned initially that we have to decentralize and make it, a public issue, sensitize people to these issues and decentralize, give more authority to different types of groups in the community, priests, school teachers, police officers, local politicians, all have to be sensitized.
So who needs to, though, spearhead improvements? Is it the federal government or the state? Is it communities or private clinics? Who takes leadership on this?
Yeah, people in our study identified that the government and private facilities have a major role to play. And it makes sense because they have the resources to spend. But until and unless they increase their spending and provide more resources, the communities have to take action on their own as well. And there are ways to, you know, form interest groups, gather more information, provide help to people. Like those who are recovering from substance abuse, for example, can be good role models for others and provide assistance.
What can people outside of the mental health care industry, so to speak, what can they do to affect change?
Yeah, clearly, I think I'm glad you asked this. Those who are old, they have lobbying for them. Children have certain amount of lobby for them in Congress. But mentally ill people, there are few lobbyists for them. We also feel like investing in mental health care is not a good idea. There's no return on investment. But you know, as long as the communities get sensitized and make a big issue, put pressure on the politicians, you know, there will be changes. But the community has to take action on its own, and everyone has to be involved. Parents, you know, spiritual leaders, religious leaders, politicians, police officers. They have to take action and, you know, get some amount of lobbying.
Jagdish, as we start to wrap up here, what do you tell your students about practicing in rural areas? How do you convince them?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I many a times I stop and say, you know, it's not only about money. Like Deb called earlier on the show, and, you know, it's the goodness of her heart that she wants to serve in a rural place where people have high need. You have to see how much good can you do and also how you can increase your and enhance your skills and really make a difference in communities. And there are people who have chosen to stay in rural America out of goodness of their heart and interest in rural health. And, you know, we have to continue to motivate people. I've lived in rural areas all my life in 3 countries, and it's been a good life. You know, people are nice. I've been able to make a difference. And we need to motivate more professionals. It's not all about, you know, going to California and living on the beach and making hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Well, Jagdish, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jagdish Khubchandani is an associate professor of health science at Ball State University. He designed the research instruments and served as a data analyst on a new survey of mental health professionals working in rural areas. This Hour of the Morning Show is produced by Keely Baltina and the Ideas Network director Cheryl Gasser. Brittany Williams provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.